The Vikings are one of the great stories of Dark Age Europe, one we're learning more and more about every day. The story of trade, violence, their way of life, their culture. The Norse myths, just for example, have always been my favourite. So when I discovered the History of Vikings podcast, I was delighted, and particularly so when I saw that Noah Tetzner, its host, dug into topics like the myths and engaged with expert academics to really get under the skin of the Vikings. So, here we are, a guest episode from Noah, something to distract you while you mull over the complex issues of the Henry VIII debate and decide how to vote. I'm sure Noah will mention it, but to find it, just search for the History of Vikings podcast in iTunes or whatever podcast you use, and there's also a Twitter feed called History of Viking. Good luck, everyone. Hope you enjoy it. Next week, it's episode 3 of the Roman Bath series, and it's the results of the Henry VIII poll and prize draw as well. See you then.
Hello, fellow listeners of the History of England. My name is Noah Tetzner, and I host a podcast called The History of Vikings. On my podcast, we explore every aspect of the people we know today as Vikings, from Norse mythology and monastery raids to Viking longships and the humble farmstead. Do be sure to check out my podcast, The History of Vikings, wherever you get your podcasts from. Every episode features an in-depth discussion with a Viking Age or Norse mythology-related guest, and David Crowther was kind enough to let me share one of those discussions with all of you today. In just a few moments, you will be hearing a conversation I had with Professor of Medieval History at Yale University, Anders Winroth. The topic of our discussion was daily life during the Viking Age, and of course we ended up covering much more than solely that. From modern misconceptions to Norse mythology, this episode touches on many fascinating pieces of history, and I do hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to the History of Vikings. Today I'm joined by Anders Winroth, Professor of Medieval History and Bridget Baldwin Professor of History at Yale University. Now, Anders Winroth is just an inspirational figure amongst the Viking scholars, and he wrote an excellent book, which I'll put a link to in the description of the show, called The Age of the Vikings, and I actually have a copy of it right in front of me here on my desk, and it's just a remarkable book. It talks about anything you would ever want to know about the Vikings, from their warlike lifestyle to the everyday life of the Vikings. So I do implore you to go check that out. But Anders Winroth, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much, Noah, and thank you for your kind words.
It's my pleasure. So why don't you start us off by simply this? You know, there's sort of this enduring image of the Vikings as warriors and raiders and men with blood-stained tunics and unkempt hair and possibly even double-edged axes and horned helmets, but there's many myths surrounding the people that we know today as Vikings. So what do you think are some of the biggest myths surrounding the Vikings in modern day culture?
Well, there are plenty of myths. I mean, one obvious one that one immediately thinks about is the horned helmet that you mentioned. They did not actually wear horned helmets. And if one thinks about it for even a short while, one realizes it's very unpractical to wear a helmet with something protruding from it if one is going out into fights where one battles with swords and sticks and axes, because then it's very easy to knock the helmet off your head. The horned helmet is a 19th century invention, so it has little to do with that. And I don't think they were unkempt. The Vikings have a reputation for, and in fact did in the at the time, have a reputation for being quite well kempt. They combed their hair. They bathed every Saturday. The word for Saturday in the Scandinavian languages actually means bathing day. And one thinks that maybe they bathed every day. There's even evidence. There's an English chronicler who says that these Vikings, they come and they smell good. And our English women run away with the Vikings because they actually wash and comb their hair. I don't know if that's true, but it is in an actual medieval source that says so. But I can continue to talk about other myths about the Vikings. The Vikings have, in particular, this reputation for being particularly violent. And it is certainly true that they were violent. They could even be very violent. But I think when one says that, one must remember that this is the early Middle Ages. which was in general a very violent time. And the Vikings were a kind of freeloading entrepreneurs of violence. They did not really have the technology or the wherewithal to inflict a lot of violence in the way that a state can do it. So, for instance, the earliest Vikings are contemporaries of the great Emperor Charlemagne, who's, you know, sort of generally considered one of the founding figures of Europe. And, I mean, he was a king and an emperor. He had an army, he had a large army. He could inflict a lot of violence, and he regularly did. The reason why we think that the Vikings are especially violent is that in their case, the Vikings attacked people who could write and people who were accustomed to write. I mean, they attacked the monasteries and churches of Europe, which is where literacy resided in the Middle Ages. So in their case, we hear the stories of the victim more than we hear the stories of the Vikings themselves, which is much harder to get to. While in the case of, for instance, Charlemagne, we only know about his feats through the people that he paid to write about his feats. So in other words, when they're written down, they are immediately given a positive spin.
That's fascinating, and certainly talked about it on the show before, and I just really think it is important to revise this view that we have of the Vikings as these uncivilized barbarians. But stemming off that question, I mentioned your book earlier, and I've just fallen in love with it. I read it all the time. Yeah, I have bookmarks in it and things highlighted because I reference it when doing research for my show. But my favorite chapter of the book is the chapter on the Viking farm. And what I love about that chapter is it just gives us, based on archaeological evidence, a glimpse of the Vikings at home and what they were doing when they weren't raiding. So, you know, what were the Vikings doing when they weren't off raiding and pillaging monasteries?
They essentially did the normal things that people did in the Middle Ages. And, you know, depending on their status in life, they could, some were farmers, some were chieftains. So they did, in those cases, they did different things. I mean, in a way, it's an interesting question because the word Viking actually, I mean, it's usually understood as an ethnic label for early medieval Scandinavians, but the word actually means pirate. So Viking is not a term for a people, it's a term for a job. And that job was to raid and plunder. So in a way, if one asks, what do Vikings do? The answer is raid and plunder, because that's the definition of the word. But of course, what one is interested in as a historian or generally interested, curious person is, what did they do? What did the people who were Vikings do other than raiding and plundering? And then they did a lot of things. What I find interesting, I mean, I'm very happy that you liked the chapter about that I call At Home of the Farm, which is actually the chapter I think I had the most fun writing and researching. Maybe we can get back to that. But what I first wanted to mention is that the reason why the Vikings could be raiders and plunderers were their ships, the ships that allowed them to get to the places where they wanted to raid and plunder. But they also used those ships for many other things, for instance, to trade. Early medieval Northern Europe is a very interesting area where there is a lot of trade going on, maybe not large volumes, but certainly large values, where these are Vikings who are not raiding and plundering for the moment, are transporting valuable goods across Northern Europe and selling it on markets, I mean, all over Europe, frankly, on markets on the coasts of France, on the coasts of England, all the way over in Russia and so forth. They encounter Arabic merchants from the Arabic Caliphate, and they sell stuff to them. And then they take home the pay they get, which is silver, silver being money in the early Middle Ages, silver made into coins. And thanks to their ship technology, they are able to go essentially all over the place as long as there is water, both on the oceans and the inland seas, and also on the rivers of Europe, and especially Eastern Europe has a lot of rivers. They can transport the good goods to where they can sell it. They can also go far to get the goods that they want to sell. I mean, just to take one example from many of things that the Vikings could make a lot of profit from, walrus ivory. This is the teeth of walrus. Walruses, who, as you know, live in the far in the Arctic North. So you can find them, or you could find them in the Viking Age. You could find them in northern Norway or in northern Iceland, and especially in Greenland. That's probably why the Vikings also settled Greenland. And they went there, got the teeth, and they brought it to Europe, where it was sold, and then it was used in the same way as elephant ivory was used for producing works of art. And this was particularly profitable because the Viking Age was a time when Europe had problems getting elephant ivory from Africa or India because the trade routes there had been disturbed.
Wow, that's fascinating. I've always been fascinated with, you know, trading networks and sort of merchants. And it's just fascinating to understand the Vikings as having this trade network and the sort of goods that they traded. But I'd love to, again, go back to your book and go back to, I mean, it's just filled with so many great things. Anything you would ever want to know about the Vikings. But again, going back to the chapter At Home on the Farm. So you mentioned you really enjoyed writing that. And what are some of the things that you've discovered while researching that chapter? What are some of your favorite parts?
The Swedish authorities were going to broaden a road. And in Sweden, one always has the practice of, when there is some kind of construction work like that going on, you first send in the archaeologists to check that you are not destroying something valuable. And the archaeologists found this well-preserved skeleton from the early 11th century. And because the site where the skeleton was found was very close to these rune stones that had been standing there since the 11th century, they were able to very plausibly identify the woman whose skeleton they had found with the woman who paid for those runestones to be raised. And it's very unusual that you can associate a particular skeleton with a particular name when the skeleton is so old. I mean, yes, with kings and such, but it's very unusual with more normal people, because most of the time there is not that connection to some written evidence and the skeleton. So here we have a woman that we already knew quite a lot about, because she and her family, they were wealthy people. They were sort of dominant powers in this little corner of Sweden. They had raised a lot of runestones that had been interpreted and read long ago. So on the one hand, we know all these things, and then suddenly we have her skeleton. So then we know how tall she was, how old she got, what her body type was. She was small and lithe. We know suddenly that she broke her arm at one point, but that it healed nicely, so it was taken care of. All these personal details that there's barely anybody else who is mentioned in a runestone that we know things like that from, or about, I should say. And also, she's buried, she was a Christian, but she would be in the first generation or two of Christianity in Scandinavia. So she is buried with things in her grave goods, which Christians are not supposed to be. And those tell us things about her as well. So she's buried with these weights that were used on medieval scales or balances. So those scales were used to measure the weight of silver when you were doing transactions with money, because you didn't count the coins you weighed, how much they weighed, and that determined their value. And because she was buried with these weights, one gets the idea that means that she was the one who was, well, at least when she died, she was responsible for weighing the silver. In other words, for managing the economics of the farm that she and her family were running. And that's fascinating in itself. And that gives the background to that she could afford to have all these runestones erected.
That's fascinating. And before we move on from this topic, I feel like a lot of people really, could you just kind of clarify for those people who are new to the Vikings, you know, what were the runestones? Certainly they're illustrations carved into rocks and stones.
If you look at runes, I mean, you can look them up on the internet, you will see that they actually look rather similar to our letters. But you can see that whoever designed them has tried to avoid, is drawing as few lines as possible. So for instance, the rune that means an N, a capital N, a normal N, is two vertical lines and one diagonal. In the rune, you have only one vertical line and the diagonal, and then similarly with other letters. So clearly, at some point, almost 2,000 years ago, Scandinavians, or Northern Europeans in general, imported the Roman alphabet and started to use it themselves in this simplified version. And since they wanted to save on lines, that tells us that it was hard work to write a rune, which tells us that they were not writing on parchment or paper or something, but they were inscribing them in some medium. Most of it wood, which we know very little about, because wood that is that old usually has disappeared by now. But they also inscribe it in stone, and then one can understand that they wanted to draw as few lines as possible. So they incised them, inscribed them into stones, and then in the Viking Age, there was a real fashion for raising stones, finding a nicely shaped stone, making an inscription on it, and then standing it up so people could see it. This was a way in which you could boast about what a great person you were who, well, obviously could afford to have a runestone made and raised. But also the text often tell you something about the person who had the stone erected. And that is another way they can boast. I mean, there's a stone not very far from Astrid's runestone that I talked about a moment ago, where a man called Ulf says that I was in England and I got paid by King Knut and others for fighting for them. So we know that this man from Sweden was part of the army that conquered England for Knut the Great in 1016, thanks to these runestones. I mean, the runestones are marvelous because that's one of the few sources that allow us to hear the voice of the Viking and not just the victims. And one can use the runestones to figure out what the Vikings thought were important. And Astrid was somebody who had several runestones erected, and I used the inscriptions on those stones to tell the story of Astrid in the book. I mean, partially actually in her own words.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating, you know, and that is certainly a way that we can really, hear the Vikings talking to us, you know, hear their voices. But another chapter in your book that I loved was called The Religions of the North. And of course, talking about the religion of the Vikings, which of course we know today as Norse mythology. And, you know, we've talked about Norse mythology quite extensively here on the History of Vikings. And I've outlined many of the various Norse myths. But how did the Vikings view their gods? Did they fear their gods? Did they see their gods more of friends?
Thought of them as friends. They seem to have believed that they might just show up. The Icelandic sagas, which of course are much later than the Viking Age and much later, written down long after anybody still believed in these gods. The Icelandic sagas tell several stories about various gods coming, I mean, showing up suddenly in a house or whatever. And, you know, it's usually the usual story that at first you don't recognize who it is, but then when he leaves, you realize, oh, that was Odin or Thor or something. They certainly sacrifice to them. They certainly try to make them happy. It's very difficult to do research on Norse mythology because the sources are very poor. But I tried to put together what one can know with some level of security in the book. The problem is that, you know, we learn from European writers about these gods, and the European writers are usually Christian, so they certainly have an axe to grind when they talk about the beliefs of the Scandinavians, who, to boot, of course, were Vikings, so they are from the beginning people that you don't like. And then we have the Icelandic sagas, and also the famous book by Snorri Sturluson, the Icelandic antiquarian who collected the stories about the Norse gods and wrote them down in the 13th century, which is more than 200 years after the end of paganism. So a lot of what is written in the Icelandic sources is literarily shaped and formed by the literary ideas of people like Snorri Sturluson, who was a great writer. If he had lived today, he would write best-selling novels, I'm sure. But it means that one cannot be certain that what they say is actually what happened. But in the book, I'm trying to use the evidence that exists, produced by Scandinavians during the Viking Age, the little that exists, and to find this story and the story of the Norse myths and the Norse gods. And there one certainly can see that people were afraid of the gods, and they respected the gods, and they sacrificed to them.
Fascinating. And for those of you who, most of you probably know this, but the book that Anders is referencing, other than his own book, the one written by the Icelandic antiquarian Snorri Sturluson, that is indeed the Prose Edda, which we've talked about before.
I think the myths about Thor are the most interesting ones. They are the most amusing ones. And I mean, especially, you know, the story of him going out to fish and fishing up the Midgard serpent, the serpent that apparently is thought to circle around the earth and hold it together. And the story of this that's preserved in some old poems that were written down in Iceland in the 13th century, I think it's just hilarious. Thor goes to this giant and they get into some sort of a kind of fight or argument about who is the most macho of the two. And of course, what happens is that they decide to go out fishing, and Thor asks the giant, where can I get the bait? And the giant is pointing to a field. I mean, obviously thinking that Thor will be digging for worms or something. But instead, Thor takes the bull on the field and tears his head off. And then he's using the head as bait. And they swim, and they not swim, of course, but they row out in a boat. And they fish, and I guess the giant is capturing whales, while Thor is capturing an even greater creature, the Midgard serpent, the enormous animal that holds the earth together, and starts to pull him up. And of course, then the earth is no longer held together, so there's earthquakes and stuff, until the giant is so scared that he uses his axe to, or maybe even Thor's axe, that's not clear, to cut off the line to the bait, so the serpent can go back down underwater and the world survives. What I really like about this story is, I mean, it's written with great humor, as preserved in this poem that is in the so-called Poetical Edda, which Professor Larrington has put out a very good translation of, by the way. But what I really like about it is that this myth is illustrated on inscribed stones, rune stones, and picture stones. Picture stones is what one calls raised stones that contain no runes, but only pictures. And you can recognize on some of these pictures, and I have at least one in my book, if not two, that's Thor and the giant who are out fishing. And you can see the snake and everything.
That's definitely an intriguing story. If I may just ask one last question before we complete our discussion today. We talked about Snorri Sturluson's Prose Edda, and I would love to know, he wrote that collection of stories in Norse myths quite a while after Christianity became the state religion of many countries and paganism sort of dissipated.
This is another of the sources that actually tells us about the Vikings in their own words. So I use this kind of poetry quite a lot in my book. The poetry is difficult to understand. It was difficult already in the 13th century, especially because it contains a lot of allusions to myths. So what Snorri wanted to do. He was an expert on this poetry. He wanted to teach others to understand it and also to compose their own poetry in the same style. But to understand it, you have to understand the myths. So he produced what is in essence a handbook in understanding poetry and enjoying poetry, but that becomes a kind of handbook to Norse mythology, or at least as he thinks it is. He used as his sources this poetry that, as I said, is hard to understand. And sometimes he misunderstood it. And because he misunderstood it, he tells stories that he actually made up that surely did not exist, certainly did not exist in the Viking Age. But that was his purpose, to explain the poetry and to teach others to write the same kind of poetry. So Snorri himself was actually quite good at writing poetry that looks as if it were written in the Viking Age. And his nephew, Sturla Thordarson, was also a very powerful poet in his own right. And some of his poetry looks like it could have been written in the Viking Age. So that was his purpose.
Anders, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been just a real treat to be able to have this conversation with you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed very much talking to you.
As I mentioned earlier, I will have a link to Anders' glorious book, The Age of the Vikings, in the description below. I do implore you to go check that out, and I'm sure if you purchase a copy, you will certainly not regret it. If you enjoyed this episode of The History of Vikings, do me a favor and write me a review. Feel free to contact me with any suggestions, questions, or inquiries that you might have. My email address is noah@thehistoryofvikings.com.